In 2021, Talk About It Outdoors partnered with an industry-leading brand that has stamped its name on the outdoor industry. Cruiser Saddles, in itself, stands on perfection. And with every climb we make, we elevate ourselves above the rest. In addition to a support to our hunting journey, the men and women behind Cruiser believe in the same principles of life as us. Faith, family, and the blessings of being better as they go in every sit. If your desire to pursue your passions one step ahead of the rest, go ahead and get in the best. Check them out on all the socials or head over to their website at www.cruiser.com. That's CRUZR.com. And tell them to Talk About It Outdoors boys and Chasing Weekends sent you their way. The journey of life has a unique way of being able to create tried and true friendships as we go. In forming those relationships, oftentimes, good things come to follow. Talk About It Outdoors is proudly supported by Cal Hardy, the Barrelhead Land Company. Cal is the leading broker over Georgia and is happy to assist you with finding the place where you can call home. With vast knowledge and an understanding of the ever-evolving real estate market and a unique old-school approach to everything he does, he exemplifies what it means to treat others like you'd want to be treated. Don't settle for being just another number in a phone. Choose Cal Hardy for all your land, home, and commercial real estate needs and become a part of his family. We sure are blessed to have him as a part of ours. Find him on Facebook, Instagram, or give him a call at 770-296-2163. Step back to the times when a feed store was more than just that, and the people inside smiled with friendly faces and provided a place for a talk on life, as well as all your essential farm, livestock, and pet needs. Cherokee Feed and Seed, located in Ball Ground, Georgia, with an additional location in Gainesville, are the hometown supplier of all your cattle, equine, and pet needs, with the added addition of being able to keep your deer herd healthy with protein and minerals. They also carry an assortment of hunting blinds and gear, and you can rest easy knowing the people that support local ball clubs and children's sports are who your hard-earned money is going to. The people here greet you with a handshake and a smile, and Cherokee Feed and Seed give more than just a product. They give you a welcome that'll make you return time and time again. Stop in next time you're in the area and tell them you're part of the Talk About It Outdoors family. A few years back, when an overbearing and overgrown backyard became an eyesore, I looked for a solution to resolve. LRS Land Services created a stunning and complete transformation turnkey at an affordable price with their mulching services. Not limited to mulching, LRS can provide turnkey grading and clearing, maintenance, right-of-way clearing, and even development for any and all forestry needs. With an innovative outlook on what is best for your land and a completely different approach than others, LRS can transform your overgrown eyesore into a beautiful landscape of your dreams. Give them a call at 404-889-1105 or check their work out on Facebook at LRS Land Services. Logan and his team are ready to make your land brand new again. Building the foundation of your life starts at the base, and the stronger it is, the better. Talk About It Outdoors is proud of our strong partnership with United Concrete and Paving and the foundation of support they provide. Whether your new home being built needs concrete work or that driveway you're tired of beating all the bearings from your pickup needs a paving, Michael and his team can provide any residential or commercial project support you might need from the ground up. If you're tired of tripping over that unsettled patio slab or a future shop build needs a smooth start, United Concrete and Paving can get you going when you need it most. Give them a call at 404-831-3036 and make sure you tell them them TAI boys are where you heard it first. You ready, Nick?
Let's do it.
All right, everybody, Talk About It Outdoors coming to you live from the Cruiser Saddle Studio once again. We're on the backside of the Georgia opener right here in our home state, and we hope we've got plenty to tell you about. But tonight, it's all about the NWTF, a grand slam, and the history of an MC that Mike could just talk about it a little more than the both of us. Y'all pull up a chair and sit a while. Nick, we're still reeling from a youth opener weekend we had this past weekend, and well, we're on the backside of this when that drops out.
We are, man. What a fantastic start! We had some okay, decent weather, and Alabama kicked off too. I saw a lot of hammers over there get dropped on a terrible day yesterday, terrible windy day. So, yeah, great weekend for us, and had a call in the bullpen on Sunday. Had some people sleep in on me, so made a Verizon wireless call to the bullpen, as the Braves say, and called you and Sawyer, got y'all up at 4:30.
Oh, I was up. I answered the phone kind of like I was on that top bunk in Florida again. Hello?
Yeah.
I thought something might be wrong when you called me. I thought, there ain't no way in the world he's calling just to chit-chat. And you said, you and Sawyer want to go hunting? I said, yeah. I said, we'll go. I said, let me go in here and get him up. And I told you, I said, call Cody first, though. I said, he might want to go. And Well, he was sound asleep.
We had plans Sunday, and I woke up at, I don't know, 7, whatever time it was, and I had 2 missed calls from Nick at 5, and I thought, oh, my God, something has went awry. And then I saw his text, and I was like, shoo, I'm glad it wasn't an emergency.
Yeah, it was a fun hunt, and you'll get to see that full video if you go over to Chasing Weekends. We've got that video dropped out already. You can see your Sawyer's first turkey and see the youth weekend in full. You even get to see a little cooking recipe we did on there. That's pretty fun. We cooked up a little turkey on Sunday, and Sawyer sure did enjoy it a lot. So,
yep. Well, the guy coming on tonight knows a thing or two about a couple of turkeys.
He has probably seen more turkeys in his lifetime than you, me, Cody, Nick, Caden, Tyler, whoever else might be coming through Talk About It Outdoors headquarters tonight than we'll ever see. And the name Rob has been synonymous with a lot of turkey hunting, especially with the NWTF, for a lot of years. And the gentleman that's coming on, well, I said in the opening there, he could talk turkey with the best of them, and probably talks better turkey than anybody that we know of. So Rob Keck, he's former NWTF CEO. He's been an MC with the Grand National Calling Convention. Welcome to Talk About It Outdoors, and we appreciate you being here.
Hey, guys, Alex, Nick, Cody, Josh, man, just thanks so much. Hey, and it's our time of year. The dogwoods are blooming, the red buds are out, and the turkeys are gobbling.
Shoo, talk about it. We're getting fired up already. That just hearing when you speak, Rob, I got to say this right out the gate, it's a very, very distinct voice, and anybody that's ever had anything to do with the NWTF and coming to Nashville or wherever it may have been in the past recognizes your voice, and it's indeed an honor and a privilege, sir, to have you here.
Well, I appreciate that, and, you know, it's all about people. NWTF, I mean, is in the people business, and, you know, in the 30 years I was there, 27 as CEO, I mean, we focused on people, especially the turkey hunter. But, you know, everybody can contribute to conservation from all walks of life, and you know what we do as hunters? We improve the quality of life for all people. I mean, you think about it. 100 years ago, turkeys were gone. In fact, there's a lot of places, they didn't come back till 20, 30 years ago. And so it went generations without anybody seeing a turkey. You know, I had a lady up in New York one time. I was up there at a seminar, and she came up to me afterwards and said, you know, I'm not a hunter. But she said, I just want to thank you so much for bringing back wild turkeys. And I said, well, tell me a little bit more. She said, well, I live in the farmhouse that I was born in. And said, as a kid, we didn't have any turkeys there. But she said, today, when I go out to my mailbox, March, April, and May, and I slam that mailbox door shut, there's an old turkey that gobbles to me up there on the ridge, and said, it just makes my day. And that's what I'm talking about. I mean, who doesn't enjoy hearing a turkey gobble in the spring or herd a deer out in the field or going out west and hearing an elk bugle? I mean, what we do as hunters, we got to stand up proud for what we love, what we believe in. And, of course, it all just comes together with us and the wild turkey.
One thing that's pretty neat that a lot of people may not realize as they're listening to this episode is I competed in my very first calling competition this year, and in 1977, you started the Grand National Calling Championship. So 9 years before I was ever even born, you started it, and now I'm getting to chat with you on the phone.
Stop telling me his age.
Well, I mean, from 1977 all the way up to 2008, Rob's been, you know, like I said, a name with the NWTF. And anyone that goes to the Grand National Calling Championship now, they recognize his name and they see Rob. And when you said he was going to get to come on the show, I started doing a little bit of research on him and started reading back a little bit. And one of the big things, and probably one of the top awards that you've probably received in your lifetime, or one of them anyway, was the Tom Kelly Communicator of the Year Award that you received this year.
Well, you know, certainly an honor. Anything with Tom Kelly's name on that you become awarded with certainly brings a lot of attention, and it's certainly an honor and a privilege, and, you know, I just am thankful. But, you know, again, it was the people out there that allowed me to really flourish. I mean, when you look at the communications that I was part of, I mean, I wrote a column that started back in 1977, ran right through to the day I left NWTF, called Talking Turkey. It was in every issue of Turkey Call magazine. But then to, you know, create Turkey Call television, get in the game, Turkey Country, you know, to produce all those television shows through NWTF and then host them. You know, I remember going back, it was at a time when really, outdoor television was really only on TNN and ESPN2. And, of course, I had the idea of a strictly turkey-type show. And I went to the folks at TNN, and they sort of laughed at me. And I said, this will work. And I said, I want to do something that you guys aren't doing, and that's putting a hunting show in the first and second quarter on TNN. They said it'll never work. Said only fishing. People only watch fishing in the first and second quarter. Well, I made three stabs at getting them to pay attention. Put together a trailer. They said, okay, we're going to put you at the death slot, 8:30 Saturday morning. Well, guess what? We were the only hunting show on TNN. And guess who the hunters out there tuned into? We had such a great rating, they moved us to prime time the next year. And so we're able to tell the story of not just turkey hunting, but the turkey, its conservation, and the people that have given so much. I mean, you think about, you know, all the work from whether it's planning and habitat management to, you know, a lot of our volunteers, they worked, you know, with a lot of the state agencies in helping move those turkeys. They were a big part of education and passing it on to our youth. And, you know, then after I left there, my good friend Johnny Morris asked me to be on that team. And I was on the Redhead Pro Hunting team and got to host, you know, King of Bucks and, you know, 100% Real Hunting. Then after that, Johnny said, I want you to host a show, a new show for us. And let's call it Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World. And that ran for 10 years on Sirius XM. And so, you know, I've had a chance to communicate and to share all the many important aspects of conservation, the success stories out there, and to tell about the people that have made all this happen. As you know, it didn't happen by accident. It took a great commitment from many, many, many volunteers out there in our chapters and working in partnership with state fish and wildlife agencies to make it all work.
Do you think that there is a more prominent name in turkey hunting than Colonel Tom Kelly and what he's done for conservation and efforts and stuff? And tell us a little bit about your history with him over the years.
Well, I knew Tom back when he was always a featured speaker at Westervelt Lodge over in Western Alabama. And, you know, that's when I first met him. And, you know, it was clear after reading 10th Legion that, you know, here's a man that really understood what this bird is all about and the people that pursue that bird and just revel in all that is Turkey. And, you know, here's a guy that certainly spoke from a military background, and so many of the stories that he would spin and tell, you know, came from that perspective. And I think that there's no question that what he has written is the finest pieces of work in his books, his stories in magazines, certainly in Turkey Call, that have ever been done. And, you know, Tom was one that just set the bar. He set it so high for other writers, other communicators, and his choice of words, the way he would make his sentences flow, but just get right down to it. I mean, got down in the dirt and told it like it was. And I mean, I don't know that we've ever seen anybody that even comes close to what Tom Kelly was able to share in words with so many people that love and just, you know, revere this greatest of game birds.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm actually halfway through the 10th Legion for my second time. And I was, there's a part in there that he wrote about turkeys can adapt more than any other wild animal, in his belief. And it may not be word for word that I'm saying that, but and it started ringing a bell that I do believe that these wild turkeys do know how to adapt with all the changes that go through their lives. And
no question.
Yeah.
I mean, you look all across the United States and see how they have adapted. You know, we've become a more urban society, and, you know, turkeys have had to adjust to, you know, the encroachment on their habitat. Then you look at some places like up in New England. I just love it when I hear people complain about turkeys, you know, in people's yards and attacking, you know, the mailman or what have you, because, you know, those homes were built in the turkey's home.
That's right.
And, you know, they've learned to live in these places in the close proximity of man. And, you know, they've adapted to changing landscapes. And, you know, we've learned so much about what turkeys like, what they don't like, whether it's for, you know, winter habitat, spring and nesting habitat, brood range, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, again, adaptation to their particular habitats has been really a key to their success.
That's right. Rob, I'm going to bring back NWTF 2022. Would have been last year. I believe it was a Friday afternoon in the watering hole. There was a couple of us up there and some of our buddies, Cody being one of them, Tyler's over here on the couch, and we were playing music over in the corner. And you, and I'm guessing it was your grandsons, all three of y'all seemed to be dressed alike, sports coat, cowboy hat. Y'all stopped by for about 30 minutes and listened to them while they were singing and playing. Do you recall that?
I do.
Yeah. So that was Cody and then Tyler sitting over there. So I didn't know if you'd remember stopping by last year listening to us.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And, you know, I had all my grandkids there this year. In fact, my youngest one just turned 10, and he's killed a half dozen turkeys with me in the past, and he's all primed up because it's Youth Weekend in South Carolina in the Piedmont this weekend. But anyway, I pulled him out of school, and he went with me on Tuesday. And then Wednesday, he sort of shadowed me when I was judging the decorative call competition. And then Wednesday night, I brought him backstage of the Opry. I brought Matt Van Sice and Paul Butsky out on stage, introduced Matt as the defending Grand National Champion, and Paul Butsky, who was the Grand National Champion back in 1986 and was the first one I was able to take on stage of the Opry. And anyway, my grandson was there on side stage and watching all this. And, we had a conservation award that, Johnny Morris, Richard Childress, and myself, presented to Chris Jansen. And, Richard grabbed hold of my grandson and said, "You're coming out with us." And we all had a piece to say. I forgot to mention Heath Davis was there, chairman of the NWTF Foundation Board. And we all had something to say about Chris. And anyway, Childress said, he pointed to Kellen, my grandson, and said, "This is what we're working for. This is the future." And, you know, it got a great applause and what have you. And then Chris, after we left the stage, Chris played his last song, last set there on the Opry stage. And he went and grabbed Kellen and brought him out with his son, Jesse. And they got to finish out the Opry there on Wednesday night. And that was more than cool. But what really topped it off, we went back to the green room after Chris finished, and Chris presented him with a Les Paul electric guitar. He knew that Kellen was taking guitar lessons, and anyway, what a special night for him.
That's cool. That's awesome. So you bring that up. We were coming through, we were actually walking by the watering hole Wednesday morning this year. I think we had finished setting up our booth and was just moseying around. And I looked at Cody and I said, "There went Richard Childress." And Cody, didn't you say, who's that?
Yeah, I wasn't a NASCAR fan.
He wasn't a NASCAR fan. He didn't know who it was, which I didn't say anything to Richard, but I kind of wish I had after the fact. But most people nowadays really don't know who Richard Childress is.
That'd have been a good show to
well, get to. I mean, he's a NASCAR Hall of Famer. And, of course, anybody that remembers Dale Earnhardt, you know, Dale drove for Richard Childress Racing.
That's right. Rob, let me ask
you. Hold on before you go any further. We got to mention that Rob's been the Grand Marshal three different times. Am I correct on that for NASCAR?
Actually four.
Four times,
I helped start four different NASCAR races.
Okay.
And I did every one of them with a turkey call.
Really?
No, that's cool.
Okay.
That's awesome.
Rob, let me ask you, because I'm picking up facts from different things and hearing different things, but you are the first known person to kill the 49 Grand Slam, right? Super Slam?
That's correct, yes. Okay.
What year did you start? And then I guess there's going to be a couple questions around it. What year did you start? What made you want to start it?
Well, I never started out planning to do that. The first turkey I killed was, and I'm really going to show my age. In fact, this will be my 61st year turkey hunting. I killed my first one in Eastern, up in northern Pennsylvania, the day after John F. Kennedy was killed. We had fall hunting up there before we ever had a spring season. And, you know, that's where, you know, I really got the bug big time. But I had it actually even earlier than that. You know, my dad and my granddad and uncles, they always talked hunting. And one of the things that they always held in high esteem was turkey hunting. And, of course, Pennsylvania, like many other states, didn't have a lot of turkeys at that time. And so it was really something if somebody killed a turkey back then. And so having, you know, accomplished that, I just made it a point that I was going to try to be the best turkey caller and hunter that I could be. Then, you know, as time went along and we got a spring season in Pennsylvania, I started taking some people that didn't know how to call, and I tried to learn from everybody that I could. Went to the Pennsylvania State Calling Championships and recorded, you know, some of that calling. And then when I graduated from college, well, actually before that, in 1969, I went during spring break. Carl Brown and I went to Alabama, and we camped out on the Coosa Wildlife Management Area, and I killed my first Alabama gobblers back in 69. And I just said to Carl, I said, "One day we're going to be at the top of the turkey world." I had no idea what I was talking about. There wasn't even a turkey federation back then. But I felt driven big time. And so when I got into teaching, which I was a high school teacher after I got out of school, I'd moved to Perry County, Pennsylvania, and there were a lot of really good turkey callers and turkey hunters from there. And Chester Lesh, who was a three-time Pennsylvania State Calling Champion, was as good as anybody on a mouth call at that time. And he really took me under his wing, and and helped me to perfect my calls, and in 74 won the state championship, and then went on, won the U.S. Open, won the world, and all that was the inspiration of guys like Chet Lesh and George Fleischer and just many others. And we, you know, traveled to competitions all over the country. I mean, when I won the world, we went to Mobile for that. And of course, when you do that, as I'm sure when many people go to the convention and you strike up friendships, I started getting invitations to a lot of different places and started hunting, you know, Virginia, West Virginia, Maryland, New York and Ohio. And just, you know, every time I could get a chance to go, I went. Alabama was a regular. And then when I finally came to the NWTF, of course, a lot of opportunities happened there as I was developing chapters. And I really wasn't thinking about being the first at doing anything other than just I wanted to experience what turkey hunt was like in different places. And then all of a sudden, I just realized, man, I could get one in every state in the country. And that was probably, early 80s. In 82, I went to the Yucatan. That was the first oscillated turkeys that I hunted. And, of course, that's not even part of the 49. But I wanted to experience everything I could. In fact, in 86, Earl Groves and I, we went to New Zealand. You know, nobody had been hunting down there, and I wanted to find out what those turkeys were like. And so I just thought, I'm going to do as much as I can in as many different places I can. And it just like one day I woke up and said, man, you don't have many more to go, and you'll have one in every state. So I don't know exactly when that light bulb came on, probably right there in the mid-80s. And, you know, I finished it in 95, but I could have actually finished it 5 years earlier. The last state that I had to take a turkey in was North Dakota. And still to this day, non-residents can't get a spring tag there. And so what was happening, guys that wanted to kill a North Dakota turkey, they'd go to Standing Rock Indian Reservation. Well, back right there in the late 80s, they were ticketing North Dakota was ticketing hunters that were coming off the reservation, even though they had a reservation tag. When they'd bring that turkey off there, they were getting arrested. And I said, well, man, I'm running the Federation. I can't afford any bad press. So it was when the governor changed and the new director came in, whom I was friends with. And I called him and I talked to him. He said, Rob, I knew you've been wanting to come to North Dakota. He said, we'll go to Standing Rock and I will go with you. And so we did that in 95, and that's what finished it up. But I was like on hold for 5 years, just waiting for some kind of an opportunity to go to Standing Rock in North Dakota, you know, without ever having a chance to, you know, to make sure I didn't have any game law violations.
Did you, now in New Zealand, and I could be wrong on this, is there a limit on turkeys you can take there, or is it just kind of like open season?
Turkeys in New Zealand are considered at the level of what wharf rats are here in the U.S.
That's what I thought. I thought they weren't a season on them there.
You know, the ranchers down there dislike anything that competes for grazing. Now, those hillsides are covered in clover. I mean, some of those beautiful clover I've ever seen, just hillsides covered in it. And, of course, they raise a lot of sheep down there. And anything that competes for the grazing of those sheep, which turkeys are out amongst them all the time, they despise. And I had four different outfitters that asked me to come and spend a couple days with them to try to show them what American turkey hunters look for. And anyway, everywhere I went, every rancher wanted us to kill every last one of them. Well, we weren't about to do that, but we certainly took our share. That was for sure. One thing down there, there are no predators, so turkeys don't fly 40 feet up into a tree to roost at night. So with no predators, I mean, they just fly up into a low-hanging limb or roost on a fence post or, you know, anything that just elevates them a little bit off the ground. So, you know, that was certainly different. And, you know, people always ask, well, you know, what subspecies are those? Well, I saw a number of color variations, but those turkeys, like turkeys found anywhere in the world, have had to have their origin in North America. The turkey is native only to North America, and it was back in 1520, Cortez took turkeys that I think it was possibly the Pueblos and the Aztecs had domesticated, and they look a lot like Goulds, and some of them look like Miriams, and we really need to do a DNA sample of those down in New Zealand just to get a little bit of their history. But anyway, Cortez took those turkeys over to Spain, and they were a gift of royalty. And then turkeys began to, you know, be spread throughout Europe. And as explorers went out into the New World and took livestock with them, turkeys were part of that. Well, there was a number of folks that were heading from Europe to New Zealand to try to establish farms. And they took goats and hogs and turkeys and chickens and all that kind of stuff. But when the farming didn't work out, those animals went feral. And of course, the turkeys just, you know, they continued to thrive on their own. And, you know, with no predators, they just really exploded down there. And so they've been there since the early 1820s. And, you know, people just, you know, when I took and fried up turkey breast, they just like, man, I can't believe you can eat these things. I mean, they considered them just vermin. And, you know, it'd be like eating a possum. I mean, they just didn't even want to try it. When I fried that stuff up, man, they were just slapping their sides on, man, I can't believe how good it is. But probably, it's really never taken off down probably, there. For
people listening to this that might want to go to New Zealand, how long is the plane ride there, Rob? I heard it's quite the adventure.
It is. Like, if you fly out of Atlanta, it's 5 hours to go to L.A., and L.A. is where you pick up your flight to New Zealand, and that's about a 15-hour flight. So it's a long trip, and that's probably why it has just never really caught on, you know, with American turkey hunters, just to travel that far. But it's a beautiful country. The people are just really hospitable. They speak English, and lots of wildlife down there. Of course, you know, you always hear about, you know, all the big game hunting that's there, but rarely to hear people talking about the turkeys, and there's turkeys everywhere.
Well, if they sponsored a couple of good old boys from the South to go over there, they'd take care of them, wouldn't they, Rob?
They would. You know, the outfitters that I went with, they all asked me if I wanted to shoot peacocks. And of course, in my mind, I'm thinking of a dumb domestic peacock, you know, walking around, spreading his tail in a barnyard. Well, it was the last day we were there. And our outfitter said, "Do you want to go shoot peacocks?" I said, "Yeah, I mean, y'all have been talking about it all the time." Well, they hunted them just like ringnecks where they, you know, they had men lined up driving, and then they posted standards, and they were more wild than the turkeys. And you talk about something magnificent pitching off those hillsides, seeing those long tail feathers. And I mean, these things were wild, like wild turkeys up here, and just beautiful. If I ever go back, I'm going to hunt peacocks too.
Okay.
I'd like to hunt a peacock. I've told that story before about that peacock attacking me in the dark one time. I've had a bad taste in my mouth for peacock ever since. So getting to shoot one with a shotgun might turn me on a little bit.
Rob, let me ask you a question about chasing this 49 thing and something that's sure. Come up as of late that I hear a lot of people talking about chasing this. How much easier it is nowadays that we have like Onyx and Hunt Stand and things like that. Do you think, I guess definitely it would have helped you back then probably because you probably had paper maps and probably calling biologists in those local states. How much do you think that has affected the way people hunt? Do you think it makes it easier for people to go out there and chase this 49 slam that they're doing so much now with these with this mapping devices?
I think there's a lot of elements that have made it easier in addition to just the mapping devices. But the answer to your question is yes, for sure. No question about it. But you look how far we've come. I mean, with turkey guns and specialized chokes and the ammunition, you look at the clothing and leafy suits and the decoys and pop-up blinds and all those things that, you know, most of that stuff wasn't even there when, you know, I started turkey hunting. And we've made it easy, a lot easier to kill a turkey today than back in the old days. I mean, you know, growing up and living in the mountains of Pennsylvania, I never heard of anybody used a decoy. And, you know, I was skeptical at first. And then, of course, you know, like anybody, you know, trial and error. And I thought, well, yeah, they can be an advantage. But I remember, you know, when decoys came out, there weren't any Jake or Gobbler decoys. I mean, it was like hens only. And it was amazing how then people, you know, just field tested trying a Jake and saw how well it worked. And, you know, then that whole element just exploded. And we've made it easier. There is no question about that than what it was back in the early days.
Now, are you still, is fall time still your favorite time to hunt turkeys over the spring?
My favorite time is winter.
Okay.
And I'm talking about January and February. And there's not a lot of states that are open then. I really hated it when Nebraska and Kansas shortened their season and got rid of that. Because they would run to January 31st. Now, there's states like Texas. There's some that are open into February. A couple parts of Florida. There's a number of them that have bow seasons that run into January, which, you know, is another option. And Maryland's got I think they've got a 5-day season. Virginia's got a 2-week season in January. But anybody that's ever hunted with a Jake decoy in the spring, you know how that gobbler reacts when he sees that Jake decoy and he runs to it, runs in full strut most of the time and comes in and attacks it. Well, just imagine if instead of one turkey came in, it was 25 or 50 or 100 longbeards at one time, gobbling, strutting, fighting. I mean, it is off the friggin' charts. And, you know, I filmed a couple television shows doing that with Bass Pro Shops. I know Dave Appleton, who had filmed all the pro team members, said, "Rob, I filmed all the subspecies." He said, "I've filmed with all the greats." He said, "I've never seen anything like this." We were in Kansas and roosted. There was probably 150 longbeards together. Well, you know, out there, I mean, I talked to my landowner friend out there just the other day, and, you know, you can find flocks 200 and 300. Back in the earlier days when that population was just expanding, there were flocks of over 1,000. And anyway, when we roosted them, made our plan on how we were going to go in, and what I take are just gobbler decoys. And what I'm talking about, I make a tail fan, and I'll take an epoxy or Bondo, a 300 Winchester short mag with the open end. It's an empty cartridge facing down. Then I'll take a carbon graphite arrow, cut about a third of it off, leave the field point on it, and slide it up inside that hollow cartridge. And then you put that in the ground, and that thing will work just like a mojo. I'd take two of them, and then I've got two Montana, the early Montana, the first ones that Montana decoys come out with, my favorite. And then I generally take a Jake. So the only one that has any weight is just that full body Jake decoy, and I set it on the ground. And anyway, turkeys on the roost, they started flying down. And when you put that many gobblers together, they make a lot of noise when they're coming off the roost. They hit the ground, they're strutting. And it's in January now, strutting, fighting, gobbling. I mean, they're just continuously reestablishing the peck order in all those different groups. And anyway, Dave Appleton, the videographer, he said, "Rob, I've never, ever seen anything like this." And I didn't even realize it exists. Well, most people don't think about turkey hunting. And they think about fall, you know, October, maybe November. They think about scattering a flock of turkeys and calling them back and working with young turkeys. I'm talking about adult gobblers. I had another one that was written up in American Hunter, and I had that writer with me. We were in Kansas along the Walnut River, and we were on a little ridge above the river, and it was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And when you put a bunch, as I said, a bunch of gobblers together, they're going to make a lot of noise, even in the middle of the afternoon. Well, I finally heard one. And I started glassing. I finally saw them. They were off the edge of a bean field. They were just loafing. They were picking and preening and just standing around on the edge of this bean field, but in the timber. And so we slid down off that little ridge, sort of belly crawled up to the edge of that bean field. And I dropped two Montanas and one of those real fans that I had and then put that Jake out. And I don't stake him. I just set him on the ground so he looks subservient. And I found that gobbling on a tube works well, but what really works the best is challenge purring, fighting purring. And I do it with my mouth call, and I do it on a slate. And you can do it on a push pin if you wanted to. And anyway, I finally got the attention of one of them, and he brought that batch across the field. And there was probably, I don't know, it's hard to count them. There might have been 75 to 100 longbeards coming across that bean field. And it looked like the field was alive. They're gobbling. They're strutting. They're fighting each other, but they're coming into those decoys when they see them. And when they get in there, they started kicking that Jake decoy around. And I mean, it was just relentless, just like they do in the springtime. And, of course, he wrote that story up as an American Hunter, and I asked him, I said, "Aren't you going to shoot one?" He said, "Rob, if I shoot one now," he said, "I'll kill 20. And, I mean, there were just so many together.
Right.
And so that is my favorite time. If I had to pick one time, it's not fall, it's not spring, it's winter when they're in those big bachelor groups. I did it with Osceolas. I had 60 Osceola longbeards in at one time on film.
You know, it's so funny to hear that because we just had Bob and Corey Hoon on, and Bob Hoon said the exact same thing. His favorite time was to hunt in the fall and the winter. And, you know, I think we don't hear that often because we're in the South, and you don't hear of many Southern guys. I know, you know, like Tom Kelly's put in the book, I guess Alabama used to have a fall season, but I was born in 85. I don't recall Georgia ever having a fall season down here, so I've never hunted in the fall nor winter.
I think if you're going to be a complete turkey hunter, you need to do it fall, winter, and spring. You learn so much. I mean, there's just so much that you can pick up that you may not really pick up going out sitting in a blind on a food plot with a decoy. I mean, that's great, but there's a lot more to turkey hunting than that.
You know, Rob, I just got into the calling a couple of years ago, and you know, you always hear of, I mean, there's so many fantastic callers that's came out of Pennsylvania and the best in the world. He lives there still to this day. And, you know, and I always hear just the short time I've been in it is how well these guys from up north, Pennsylvania sticks out more than any other, how well they call. And it always goes back to, cause they have the fall season. They hear all these different sounds. And and I do think that's true. I do think that's true because just like Corey told us last week, you hear so much more vocabulary out there in the fall.
You do. You do. I mean, you hear just virtually everything. And I think, one of the greatest learning opportunities. And you can plug some of that stuff in the spring. It's like key-keying. Man, I key-key a lot in the spring. When I know I've got hens that – or leading this gobbler around I'm trying to kill, I'll key key to them and try to bring, and a lot of times that's what works to bring the hens to you, and of course him trailing behind.
Boy, you've ruined me now, Nick. I'm gonna be key keying on that trumpet. I finally figured out how to do that a little bit. I'm gonna key on that trumpet every chance I get now.
Do it.
Nick. Yeah, Nick, gives me a hard
man. I'll tell you what. If you dial in one of those hens on that trumpet, she'll bring the whole batch with her.
Yeah.
Nick and I went this past weekend, and we got to hear some really, really close yelps waking up of hens, and it sounded just like a trumpet. They were sitting there on the limb, and it was just so – I mean, it was. You said it several times in there, Nick. It sounds just like that trumpet.
Sounds just like a trumpet.
Yeah.
What's your?
Oh, I love hearing those hens call. What? And then, you know, it gives you something to try to imitate.
What's your favorite kind of call to use all around if you could pick one? I knew that's a hard question to ask.
Look, I've been hunting solid here since South Carolina opened. Well, I was in Mexico hunting oscillated, but just in South Carolina opened in the low country. And I've had 8 different gobblers that have died in front of me, and it was a variety of calls. The guys that I took, they just like, how many dang calls do you take? And I wish I could say there was just one. I actually use my mouth call less and less. I've got aluminum lid long box that I run that I just really, really like. I've got an aluminum call that pot call that just screams. But, you know, it really depends. Like last night I took a fella. He'd never killed a turkey before. And he's a black guy that teaches hunter education in South Carolina. And big old boy. I mean, I called him Shaq. I mean, he was like a tower. He made me look like a midget. And anyway, it was really funny. I'd gotten a tip from one of the guys that was moving earth down South Carolina Waterfowl Association. They were building a shooting range. And the guy running the D9, he told me, he said, you know, every afternoon after we quit running this equipment, he said, these turkeys come, he said, we're just getting in our trucks and they come in here to where we're moving this dirt. And I thought, So I just went in there. I just popped up a pop-up blind and dropped the decoy in there, and I didn't call. We could have probably killed him without even calling, but I just soft called on a slate, and I mean, it didn't take 10 minutes from when we sat down, and I guarantee the construction guys were out of there probably 15 minutes at the most, and if I were to take in anybody in there and set up and said, we're going to kill a turkey, or they'd have laughed at me. I mean, because it was ugly looking. I mean, where they had piles of brush, you know, piled up and, you know, just dirt mounds and piles of dirt and mud and what have you. But turkeys love fresh turned dirt. And I love to go look right when somebody's gotten done discing a field or, in this case, I mean, they were just running this equipment in there, and it was a lot of loose dirt. And those turkeys were coming out of the swamp to go pick in that dirt. And I found their tracks right before I put that blind up. And, man, that gobbler came right in there, and the fella got to kill his first turkey, and it was just really cool.
That's awesome.
But well, I know I haven't answered your question. I like them all.
That's perfect. I mean, you hit it on the head, and I think – the way the world is today, though, they see mouth calls. I mean, mouth calling, especially with what Dave's done with one, but you see him using trumpets, and I don't know that I've ever seen him pull out a pot call and use, but I'm sure there's a lot of guys out there that kill them with every variety that you could imagine. But
it's actually funny you asked that, because I wrote a question down after reading part of that 10th Legion book, and I was going to ask Rob what the most unique call that he's seen over his history of hunting is, because he puts in that 10th Legion that he's seen anything from certain type of leaves that people use or anything. So
yeah,
what's the most unique call you've seen work, Rob, or just in general?
Well, I mean, you mentioned when you said that, I was going to just say a honeysuckle leaf, and I've called with them too. I had an acquaintance. He was a chapter guy from Arkansas that hunted in Texas County, Missouri, and I ran into him out there, and he had an old olive jar, and he had leaves, honeysuckle leaves in there, or whatever leaf he could find that had just come out. I mean, it was springtime, and that was real thin, and he called on that. He'd take that wet leaf out of that jar, and he'd just put it against the upper lip. You can take a piece of dental dam or take a rubber glove. You can do the same thing with that. And, you know, that just really caught my attention, and that's all he used. And he said, you know, growing up, he said that's the way his daddy and other guys in his family turkey hunted, just with leaves. That's all they used. And, you know, I think, you know, the nickel snuff can, to me, really captured my attention back in 69 when I was down in Alabama, down in the Coosa Management area. I ran into a guy down there. I was the only hunter I saw the whole time. And he was driving an old Volkswagen van. I was walking down this road, and he drove up to me, and I could see he was a turkey hunter. He was in World War II camouflage, and he rolled down the window and spit his chew out, and said, "What you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm turkey hunting." He said, "Well, so am I." Well, he ended up coming back to our tent that we had set up. We were just staying there at the horse stump camp little area. They had a little clearing there. They said you could camp at and make a fire. And anyway, he broke out his nickel snuff can. And anyway, before he left, I had one. And that's a call that I couldn't find many nickel snuff cans after that and started using plastic pill bottles. And I still carry a plastic pill bottle with me to this day. And I love the sound of a good tube call.
Nick, I didn't know your dad had ever met Rob Keck. Turkey hunting.
Out there in that army camo.
He said that. That's the first thing I thought of was old Jack out there.
Oh, man.
I mean, this dude here, man, I tell you what, he was from Sylacauga, Alabama. He lived turkeys. I mean, just, and he showed me an awful lot on that first trip down there.
I know we're on turkey calls, and I got one more question on that, and I'm sure you've got an amazing collection over the years, but is there one call in your collection that just trumps them all or stands higher as a collector piece for you? Maybe not something you use.
Absolutely. Without any question. It's the very first long box that Neil Cost made. And Neil was writing a column in Turkey Call magazine back there in the late 70s. Anyway, when he would come to Edgefield from Greenwood, he'd oftentimes bring calls along, and he wanted me to play them and tell him which one sounded really good. Many people didn't realize Neil was actually tone deaf. They came through the military with, you know, being around, you know, heavy armor and lots of shooting and no ear protection. Anyway, he'd bring these box calls, and I'd play them over lunchtime, and we'd go to the house and go through them, and I'd tell him which ones I thought, you know, worked the best. And anyway, one day he brought some in. I mean, they were just as pretty. They had inlays, checkering on them. And I liked to joke with him. And he said, "What do you think?" I said, "Neil, these are the prettiest turkey calls I've ever seen." And I said, "It's just too bad they don't sound like a turkey." Oh my God. He blew up big time. "Well, by gosh, what should it sound like?" I said, "Okay, do you know that Walter Winterbottom fence post long box that you gave to me that you said you did not like. I said, that has the sound. He said, well, do you have it close? I said, yeah. And I retrieved it and pulled it out. And I said, do you hear this high pitch and how it tails off? I said, that's got a turkey sound. And that's what I like. That's what I look for. And I don't hear that in these short boxes of yours. He said, well, give that thing back to me. He said, I'm going to go try to make one. He said, I'll give you this one back. Well, it was about 2 weeks later. He came back to Edgefield, and he had a cardboard box, and there were five long boxes in there. And the first one I picked up was a cedar. It was a cedar lid on a cedar box, and it was pretty rough cut the way he had mortised it out. And it was out of a log that came from Unicoi State Park, and it was a 100-year-old cedar log. And when I hit that thing, it was all turkey. I said, dang, Neil, you have finally arrived at making a turkey call. Then he really snorted. He said, don't you ask me to make any more of these things. He said, they're ugly. He said, they don't fit in a holster. He said, they're in the way. Turkey hunters ain't going to want to take something this big out in the woods. I said, listen to this. And so I played it, and I played each one of them. But the first one I picked up was the best one. That aged cedar was just, it was really, really dense, and it just had a ring to it that was unreal. Well, anyway, he said, will you keep them? He said, I ain't making any more of them, and don't tell anybody where you got them. I said, okay. So anyway, I was invited to do a Thanksgiving show on the Mike Douglas Show, and this was probably before you guys were even around. It was the night that Ronald Reagan was elected president. I was in Hollywood. I was on with Bob Hope, Ernest Borgnine, and Hank Williams Jr. And I came on at the end of the show, and I brought those long boxes that Neil had given me. I gave one to each one. I got the audience to Owl Hoot. I'd gobble on a tube, and then I'd have them call. And anyway, even in the hands of somebody who didn't know how to call, you could hear the turkey sound in it. Well, then they had another part to that thing to close out the show. They had a domestic turkey that was backstage, and Hank and I had played with him beforehand. And he was one of those turkeys that every sound you made, he'd gobble to. And so we thought we were going to have some fun with him. They brought the turkey out. Hank got on one side. I got on the other. And we called, and we called, and we called, and that sucker would not gobble. And all he did was strut, drum, and crap all over that friggin' stage. And it was funny as could be. In fact, I've got in my hunting room, I've got a big 8x10 of Hank and I with that turkey, and I'm holding that call. And people started asking me about it. And I took it with me to places like the Florida State Chapter Convention. Fred Bear was there, and Fred liked it. In fact, Fred signed that call. I've got it. And anyway, I finally let the cat out of the bag on who made it and where they got it. Neil was down there at that convention selling his other calls, and he was cussing me out for showing it and telling people about it. But people wanted them. Well, he finally started making them. And made a number of them. But I, in addition to that first one, I've got a set of five, and it's the only set of five checkered long boxes that Neil made, each one personalized to me, and each one out of a different combination of wood. Really a unique set. So you ask me one that stands out? Well, certainly that first cedar on cedar long box, which, you know, really opened up the whole turkey hunting world to long boxes. I mean, before that, it was Walter Winterbottom out Eminence, Missouri, that had made that box that Neil had given me that he ultimately copied to make the one that I have. And, you know, you think about all the long boxes that call makers are building out there. I mean, it all started with that. So it's really, I mean, it's the mother load of long boxes.
That's a pretty good one to have.
Yeah, that's a pretty good. I'm glad I asked that question. I thought, oh, that's just old slate call I got over here. Yeah. You plug more names in that sentence right there than I'll meet in a lifetime. Just imagine the history. And I want people that are listening to this to think about the names that you just mentioned right there. And for our generation, I mean, we're in our late 30s, early 40s for a group. And we've got an eclectic memory of guys like Hank Williams Jr. and Fred Bear. And, you know, you name names like that you've actually been on shows with them and had conversations with them. And what a life. And we've barely scratched the surface.
I would say we'd come visit you and take a look at them, but Alex can't keep his hands in his pocket. He'd be touching everything.
But I've been really fortunate to interact with, you know, many, many great people out there. And so many of them became inspirations to me. I mean, you know, you mentioned Fred Bear. I think about Kurt Gowdy. He and I did a television show together, and we've been on stage together where we spoke at the same event at the Grand Ole Opry. I think about the fact that, you know, while I was at the CEO of NWTF, I met with 5 different U.S. presidents, Premier of Canada, President of Mexico. I got invited to Mexico by President Vicente Fox. He presented me with their National Tourism Award for all the turkey hunters that I had been sending to Mexico. I mean, it just, that was an experience. I thought I was in a Zorro movie. Man, when I got off the plane, there were all these Mexicans that met me with AK-47s. I thought, holy crap, what have I walked into? But that was just his security detail. And I know one thing, I was sure happy to kiss the ground of the USA when I got back here.
What was
people don't realize what we have.
What was,
you know, it's just, you know, when you travel out of this country, you only begin to realize just how great of a land with everything that's screwed up here. Let me tell you, there's no place like America.
Amen to that. What was George Washington like when you met him, Rob?
George Washington. Wow.
I'm sorry. I couldn't help it.
I showed him how to use a wing bone.
Rob, let's speak on the, you talking about going out of the country, and you sent me some pictures a couple of weeks ago. You were down in, where were you at, Guatemala, maybe?
No, it was in the Yucatan.
Yucatan, okay.
South Mexico. It's in the Yucatan Peninsula. There's 3 states. Yucatan, then south of the state of Yucatan is Campeche, and then to the east is Quintana Roo. All of them have oscillated turkeys, but I was hunting with my good friend Manuel Enriquez of El Halcón Outfitters, and we talked while we were there. I said, gosh, Manuel, how many years have we hunted together? And ended up it's 28. Now, most of that was over in Chihuahua hunting Gould's turkeys, but he runs as good an operation as anybody down there. Built a new lodge about 3 years ago, and one thing about him, he was educated at University of Oklahoma. He understands American hunters, and he is passionate about turkey hunting himself, and he's a good businessman, and the attention to details. I mean, the paperwork. I mean, to bring your turkeys back into the state, you got to have, you know, CITES permits, and he handles all that stuff extremely well. But, you know, there in the Yucatan, you've got 2 places you can hunt. You can hunt in the jungle, or you can hunt in some of the farmland. And the Mennonites have moved in there about 25 years ago, and they plant a lot of grain crops. And while we were there, the big crop was Milo. And these turkeys, these oscillated turkeys, literally come out of the jungle into these Milo fields. And a lot of fun there. But I love hunting in the jungle. The sounds that you hear, you cannot relate to. I mean, when you go out in the woods, I mean, you know what a redbird is. You know what a crow is. I mean, you hear a barred owl. You're familiar with all those sounds. Boy, down there, I mean, you've got parrots. You've got guans. You've got howler monkeys. I mean, there's stuff that you think's going to eat you alive. And anyway, it is quite an experience in that jungle to hunt these birds. They obviously have a different sound than our gobbler does, but when you hear it the first time, you'd never forget it. And everyone that, you know, kills a turkey with Manuel, all of those are called in. They're called up just like you would call a turkey in here. But it is just the most beautiful bird. That bird's about half the size of an eastern gobbler, but I can tell you one thing. You got a great chance on killing your first set of 2-inch spurs down there. They're not bearded, but the plumage is absolutely gorgeous. I mean, they're a spectacular looking bird. And when you hunt them, you know you're hunting turkeys. I mean, they act just like an eastern turkey and look a little different, sound a little different. But if you want to have a completion of your world slam, you've got to get one of those. And you know, if you're interested in going, I'm not paid by Manuel, but I can speak that I've sent hunters with him for many, many years, and I've never heard anybody say they didn't have just a first-class experience hunting down there with him. And that's both in Chihuahua for Goulds and for Oscillated in the Yucatan.
Wow. World traveler, Nick.
That's beautiful. That's one you sent me. I guess it had close to 2-inch spurs, if not bigger, didn't it, Rob?
He did. He was 2 inches. The other one was inch and 7/8.
Wow.
Since I've been there, they've killed, I think, 4 or 5 over 2 inches. I think 2 1/4, 2 1/16, 2 1/8. And anyway,
just, do they scream? Do they scream instead of gobbler? What's different about them?
Well, they do. They've got a drumming sound. If you took an empty 5-gallon gas can and you tapped on the side of it, just tump, 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 tump. It's a drumming sound. And I will actually try to play one. I don't know if we can hear it over the phone or not. I've got it recorded here on my phone. And it's a pretty cool sound. And let me see if I can see if you guys can pick up on this thing.
Oh yeah!
Did you hear that?
Yeah!
Wow, that's wild.
Here, I'll play it again. I'll play it again. Now that's the gobble.
Wow!
That's what the gobble sounds like of the oscillated turkey.
Like a woodpecker starting
he's
up.
He's talking about a plastic gas can, and my stupid self sitting here thinking, "Well, that's awful loud beating on a metal gas can."
No, I'm sorry. It's a plastic gas can. A lot of times when they're coming in, they just do that thumping sound or that drumming sound, and you can hear him, and just boom, boom, boom. And the Mayan guide that's with you has got a set of ears like beyond compare, and he can hear him long before you do. You know, I've been amazed. I was hunting him in Guatemala one time with Lovett Williams, and anyway, that particular morning I killed one, and we came out on this jungle road, and it was going to be a couple hours before we were going to get picked up. So I hung the turkey in the tree, and I'm there making conversation with my guide, my Mayan guide, by making pictures in the sand because he couldn't understand me and I couldn't understand him. And all of a sudden I saw him just go on point. I mean, he was locked down on something that was off to the right side of that jungle road, and he goes, "Faizant, Faizant," and he started raising his fingers, and he went, 1, 2, 3, 4, Faizant, and shortly, at about 50 yards, one Faizant, which is a bird about the size of an oscillated turkey, second one, a third one, and a fourth one come up and stand on that road and look at us, and I'm thinking, you got to be kidding me. He could hear them walking in the leaves and knew how many there were. I mean, it just, you know, they're so attuned to every sound and just the woods itself. I mean, it's on that same level as an African tracking guide. I mean, it just blows your mind. I mean, we don't have anywhere near the skill that those guys do, and being able to hear, and not only hear, but know exactly what they're listening to. We're looking at a track and telling you how fresh it is. I mean, it's just like, you got to be kidding me.
That's crazy. I love it. And for everybody that's listening to these stories that, that Rob's telling, you're not going to get a lot of this information online. And I can tell you, we're going to have Rob back on to do it. We're going to have to do several episodes. We might have to do a Rob Keck episode series and kind of hear different stories from around the world. Because for what it's worth, Rob, you're probably as well-versed in the wild turkey as any human being walking the face of the earth today. But your outdoor skills, not only in turkey, but in everything, is so much further than probably anyone realizes.
Well, a lot of people, thank you. You're awful kind, and you're maybe stretching a little bit, but you know, most people don't realize that I chase big whitetails, and you know, I'm just crazy about hunting old age class deer. And of course, we don't have many booners in South Carolina. You know, our genetics are coastal plain deer, but you know, hunting a 5-6-year-old deers is something that, you know, when you can kill those in the South with a bow, you're really talking about something. But, you know, I go to Kansas and Illinois and Iowa and others just in pursuit of big deer. And over the years, been really, really fortunate to kill some great ones. I mean, I've got two over 200, a couple over 180, two over 185. Number of them 170s, and it's just, you know, there's just so much of a draw. I love calling deer, and I rattle, grunt, and I won't even go into that side of things, but I just, you know, crazy about that stuff too.
Don't worry, we'll get that back on about August, September. I'll say, Nick, why don't you hit a Rob up? Let's get him on top of the deer hunting calling tactics. That'd be a lot of fun. But I mean, it's amazing to listen to you talk about the anything that you do. You have a passion that you speak on so much. I've listened to you on other podcasts, and was actually listening to one today, the 100% Wild podcast you did. And you speak in such a way that it makes your voice very easy to listen to, and emceeing the events and things that you've done. I mean, it's been an honor to talk to you for the last hour, for sure. I want to sit down and talk to you in person sometime, and I promise, Cody, I'll keep my hands off his turkey calls unless he says, hell, Alex, go over and get your hands on that one. You can play that one there.
Well, just anytime you want to come. I mean, y'all aren't that far away.
No, not at all.
Let me touch on one more thing real quick. When you're emceeing up there at the Grand Nationals, I guess you thoroughly enjoy that, for one, because you like being around it. I guess, what do you think the NWTF is? You think they're doing a good thing with the way they're trying to change the call sequence and things like that, Rob? Or is there anything else out there that you see from the past calling history that you'd like to see more of now?
I think they're working really hard to try to get the very best out of the callers that are there, to do it in a fair way, a way that judges will be as accurate as they possibly can. And I think that there's just a real commitment that is there to improve. And, you know, they continue to make some changes. And, you know, when they find things that don't work, they change it out and try something new. So I think they're really trying to work hard on the caller's behalf so that it's fair, it's equitable, and brings out the best of what that caller can do with a call.
Yeah, I agree. And I like when you ended up, this is my first year calling up there. I didn't make the cut, but I enjoy, like, when you break down each person's call after the fact. This year, mm-hmm. Mark got to stand up there with you, which I thought was great.
Sure.
Kind of brings some more of excitement so you can bounce questions back and forth.
You bet.
Is there things that happened in the past at these calling competitions that you don't see now that you'd like to see incorporated back into them?
I don't really. There's nothing comes to mind that makes me want to do that. I really think that it has materially progressed to a way that it's great for the audience. It's good for the callers. It gives the judges something to really to act on when they're asked to score these calls. And I'm really not wanting to go back to anything in the past that I can think of.
Okay.
I'm thinking it's gone in the right direction.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree too. And I think it went a little quicker this year in the finals as well.
It did. It did. It
seemed like it flowed a little bit more smoothly, mixing those couple of calls in there together.
No, I thought this year was as good as any. And, I really liked having Mark there and certainly enjoyed being with Mark. And, you know, we share a lot of passion. In fact, excuse me, I had him, out on stage at the Grand Ole Opry then on Saturday night with Van Cise. And, you know, I bring out the defending champion at Wednesday night Opry, and then Saturday night I bring out the new one. Well, he's not been new. I mean, for the ninth time, you know, there we were. But anyway, Mark loves the Opry, and he's a big Del McCurry fan. Last year I brought him backstage. He got to meet Del and listen to some of his bluegrass there in the green room, and that was pretty cool. And anyway, we just share a lot of the same passions there, you know, beyond turkey hunting. And anyway, it was just great to have him up there on stage with me as we were, you know, talking about each one of the callers that just delivered their calls.
Well, I enjoyed that. If you don't mind, Rob, I'm gonna read a little scripture real quick right here at the end. If you want to say any more after I read it. So I've been trying to find something all week to try to read, and I go back to last weekend's hunt with Sawyer, and it really made me think. Something I looked up was 1 Timothy 4:12. Let no man despise thy youth, but be thy example of the believers in the word and conversation and charity and spirit and faith and purity. Flip over to 1 Peter 5:3. Neither as being lords over God's heritage, but being examples to the flock. And that really made me think about this weekend with Sawyer, because I set myself up as an example that I wanted to show him right and wrong. And
there's a lot of meat.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say I don't feel like that we do a good enough job, not just to kids, like adults, like showing each other, like it's okay to do certain things. It's okay to teach certain things. You know, we was out there and was trying to teach Sawyer about those whippoorwills and stuff like that. You know, just stuff that you're trying to be an example and be a good steward to those kids. But I think it's not just kids. We got to do it to adults as well. So
you taught him how to cover up hen tracks too.
I taught him how to cover up gobbler tracks. So,
you know, on that subject, I think all of us have a huge responsibility in trying to set the kind of example, be the kind of example that, we need to be. I mean, when the general public's looking at us, the attacks that we have on hunting, or just the hunger that so many people have to want to get out there in the field and want to see, you know, what's the ethical way to do it. And that piece of scripture captures it right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that hit the nail right on the head. I mean, that's great. Because I felt like from beginning to end all weekend, you and I got to spend two wonderful days together. We showed every piece of what I wanted to show, you know, and I didn't think we missed anything. Mm-hmm. And even Sawyer, I was skinning that turkey and I'd put it in the box out there. I was gonna haul the rest of it out. He said, well, you left a bunch of meat on the back of this turkey. He said, what about that? We need to cut that off. And I was like, no, we're not gonna cut the backbone out of it, buddy. It's not, we got what we needed to get out of it.
When I was growing up, we didn't throw it away. We made soup out of that.
There you go. What's your favorite way to cook a squirrel? I gotta ask that, Rob.
Well, first of all, I want to skin it. I don't like to cook it with the fur on. Oh, man. Squirrel gravy. I like it fried right in a big iron skillet.
I love it. That's my favorite way too. I saw you had posted, or they had a little biography about you online, and you said you liked to eat squirrel, and I was like, that's my kind of man right there.
last question I got for you, Rob. Outside of your home state, what's your three favorite states in North America to hunt?
They'll be the next three that I hunt this spring.
There you go.
Good answer. The next three.
You know, that's a hard one. It's a matter of, what do you want? Do you want to see palmettos and Spanish moss, or do you want to be right up at snow line? I love all of it. And, I thrill at God's creation to watch a sunrise coming over the Pacific on the big island of Hawaii to just being in a mountain area of, let's say, Montana, where, you know, you're following these turkeys up at snow line, right where that first green grass is popping out, to, you know, being in Delaware, listening to the waves lap onto the shore where I killed my Delaware bird. I mean, there's so many different things that God has given us. It's hard for me to pick one over the other. And it really depends what mood you're in a given day. I love so many different parts of this great world, this nation that the Lord has given us, and just appreciate every bit of it. And, the people that are there that you're with, I mean, they help make it special as well. So I know I didn't answer your question, but I find goodness and I find turkeys and find just the love that we have for the great outdoors, virtually every state that's out there.
I think you answered it perfectly.
Yeah,
I think
that's right. That's perfect.
Hey, Rob, I want to say thank you for coming on. Thank you for taking your time out this afternoon. Please keep in touch with me. Send me some photos. I'll send you some photos. And safe travels out there this spring, man.
Well, you mentioned a whippoorwill before we go. We got to listen to one for sure.
I love a whippoorwill.
I do too. No springs here when one comes on.
That's right.
Y'all got anything?
You know, we've got to enjoy all of it, not just the turkey, but all those sounds that God's given us out there. I mean, who doesn't thrill to all those different sounds, from the barred owl to the whippoorwill to the redbird to the crow? I mean, all of them make this experience that we have so special. You know, people say many times, man, did you get a big one? Did you get a trophy? And I'd say, yep, we had a trophy experience. Forget the turkey, just the experience that you share, the example you set. And so just remember that when you're out there in the spring, to enjoy every bit of it. It's more than just a sack full of feathers and meat and a beard and spurs. It's something that we ought to hold dear and treasure and do everything we can that we can pass it on to the next generation.
Oh, hey, God, I can't. So yeah. There's nothing.
How you going to finish that up?
He put my final spit right on it there. So, you know, I hope everyone enjoyed that right there with Rob, and I hope you get something out of that word there. Don't worry, Rob Keck's going to be coming back to talk about it outdoors in the very distant future.
Rob, you have a good afternoon, man, and again, safe travels this spring, and be in touch.
Yeah, you too, guys. Be safe. Alex, Nick, Cody, Josh, Todd, thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Smile as you go and mouth of memories. There's nothing else for me to say.
Building the foundation of your life starts at the base, and the stronger it is, the better. Talk About It Outdoors is proud of our strong partnership with United Concrete and Paving and the foundation of support they provide. Whether your new home being built needs concrete work or that driveway you're tired of beating all the bearings from your pickup needs a paving. Michael and his team can provide any residential or commercial project support you might need from the ground up. If you're tired of tripping over that unsettled patio slab, or a future shop build needs a smooth start, United Concrete and Paving can get you going when you need it most. Give them a call at 404-831-3036 and make sure you tell them them TAI boys are where you heard it first. A few years back, when an overbearing and overgrown backyard became an eyesore, I looked for a solution to resolve. LRS Land Services created a stunning and complete transformation turnkey at an affordable price with their mulching services. Not limited to mulching, LRS can provide turnkey grading and clearing, maintenance, right-of-way clearing, and even development for any and all forestry needs. With an innovative outlook on what is best for your land and a completely different approach than others, LRS can transform your overgrown eyesore into a beautiful landscape of your dreams. Give them a call at 404-889-1105 or check their work out on Facebook at LRS Land Services. Logan and his team are ready to make your land brand new again. Are you in need of a decluttering barn or garage slap full of stuff you just don't need? Or is your construction site needing a dumpster? Give our buddy Tony at Georgia Junk and Dumpster Rental a call. With services ranging from junk removal to roll-offs, Georgia Junk is here to help with any and all removal needs. If it's time to get that parking spot back or the boat needs a place inside, Tony and his team can surely assist. Servicing Cherokee, Cobb, Bartow, and surrounding counties, give them a call at 404-406-3501 or check them out on Facebook at Georgia Junk. Clean up the yard in short order with Georgia Junk.